This is Audible.
Black Hawk Down by Mark Bowden, read by Alan Sklar.
It makes no difference what men think of war, said the judge. War endures. As well ask men what they think of stone. War was always here. Before man was, war waited for him. The ultimate trade, awaiting the ultimate practitioner. Cormac McCarthy, Blood Meridian. The Assault. Chapter 1. At liftoff, Matt Eversman said a Hail Mary. He was curled into a seat between two helicopter crew chiefs, the knees of his long legs up to his shoulders. Before him, jammed on both sides of the Black Hawk helicopter, was his chalk. 12 young men in flak vests over tan desert camouflage fatigues. He knew their faces so well, they were like brothers. The older guys on this crew, like Eversman, a staff sergeant with 5 years in at age 26, had lived and trained together for years. Some had come up together through basic training, jump school, and ranger school. They had traveled the world, to Korea, Thailand, Central America. They knew each other better than most brothers did. They'd been drunk together, gotten into fights, slept on forest floors, jumped out of airplanes, climbed mountains, shot down foaming rivers with their hearts in their throats, baked and frozen and starved together, passed countless bored hours, teased one another endlessly about girlfriends or lack of same, driven out in the middle of the night from Fort Benning to retrieve each other from some diner or strip club out on Victory Drive after getting drunk and falling asleep or pissing off some barkeep. Through all those things, they had been training for a moment like this. It was the first time the lanky sergeant had been put in charge, and he was nervous about it. Pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen. It was mid-afternoon, October 3, 1993. Eversman's Chalk 4 was part of a force of U.S. Army Rangers and Delta Force operators who were about to drop in, uninvited, on a gathering of Habargidir clan leaders in the heart of Mogadishu, Somalia. This ragged clan, led by warlord Mohammed Farah Aidid, had picked a fight with the United States of America, and it was, without a doubt, going down. Today's targets were two of Aidid's lieutenants. They would be arrested and imprisoned with a growing number of the belligerent clan's bosses on an island off the southern Somali coast city of Kismayo. Chalk 4's piece of this snatch and grab was simple. Each of the four ranger chalks had a corner of the block around the target house. Eversman's would rope down to the northwest corner and set up a blocking position. With rangers on all four corners, no one would enter the zone where Delta was working, and no one would leave. They had done this dozens of times without difficulty, in practice and on the task force's 6 previous missions. The pattern was clear in Eversman's mind. He knew which way to move when he hit the ground, where his soldiers would be. Those out of the left side of the bird would assemble on the left side of the street. Those out of the right side would assemble right. Then they would peel off in both directions, with the medics and the youngest guys in the middle. Private First Class Todd Blackburn was the baby on Eversman's bird, a kid fresh out of Florida high school, who had not yet even been to ranger school. He'd need watching. Sergeant Scott Gallantine was older, but also inexperienced here in Mog. He was a replacement, just in from Benning. The burden of responsibility for these young rangers weighed heavily on Eversman. This time out, they were his. As chalk leader, he was handed headphones when he took his front seat. They were bulky and had a mouthpiece and were connected by a long black cord to a plug on the ceiling. He took his helmet off and settled the phones over his ears. One of the crew chiefs tapped his shoulder. "Matt, be sure you remember to take those off before you leave," he said, pointing to the cord. Then they had stewed on the hot tarmac for what seemed an hour, breathing the pungent diesel fumes and oozing sweat under their body armor and gear, fingering their weapons anxiously, every man figuring this mission would probably be scratched before they got off the ground. That's how it usually went. There were 20 false alarms for every real mission. Back when they'd arrived in Mog 5 weeks earlier, they were so flush with excitement that cheers went up from Blackhawk to Blackhawk every time they boarded the birds. Now, spin-ups like this were routine and usually amounted to nothing. Waiting for the code word for launch, which today was Irene, they were a formidable sum of men and machines. There were four of the amazing AH-6 little birds, two-seat bubble-front attack helicopters that could fly just about anywhere. The little birds were loaded with rockets this time, a first. Two would make the initial sweep over the target, and two more would help with rear security. There were four MH-6 little birds with benches mounted on both sides for delivering the spearhead of the assault force, Delta's C Squadron, one of three operational elements in the Army's top-secret commando unit. Following this strike force were eight of the elongated troop-carrying Blackhawks, two carrying Delta assaulters and their ground command, four for delivering the Rangers, Company B, 3rd Battalion of the Army's 75th Infantry, the Ranger Regiment out of Fort Benning, Georgia, one carrying a crack CSAR, Combat Search and Rescue Team, and one to fly the two mission commanders, Lieutenant Colonel Tom Matthews, who was coordinating the pilots of the 160th SOAR, Special Operations Aviation Regiment, out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and Delta Lieutenant Colonel Gary Harrell, who had responsibility for the men on the ground. The ground convoy, which was lined up and idling out by the front gate, consisted of 9 wide-body Humvees and 3 5-ton trucks. The trucks would be used to haul the prisoners and assault forces out. The Humvees were filled with Rangers, Delta operators, and 4 members of SEAL, Sea Air Land, Team 6, part of the Navy's Special Forces branch. Counting the 3 surveillance birds and the spy plane high overhead, there were 19 aircraft, 12 vehicles, and about 160 men. It was an eager armada on a taut rope. There were signs this one would go. The commander of Task Force Ranger, Major General William F. Garrison, had come out to see them off. He had never done that before. A tall, slender, gray-haired man in desert fatigues, with half an unlit cigar jutting from the corner of his mouth, Garrison had walked from chopper to chopper and then stooped down by each Humvee. "Be careful," he said in his Texas drawl. Then he'd move on to the next man. "Good luck." Then the next. "Be careful." The swell of all those revving engines made the earth tremble and their pulses race. It was stirring to be part of it, the cocked fist of America's military might. Woe to whatever stood in their way. Bristling with grenades and ammo, gripping the steel of their automatic weapons, their hearts pounding under their flak vests, they waited with a heady mix of hope and dread. They ran through last-minute mental checklists, saying prayers, triple-checking weapons, rehearsing their precise tactical choreography, performing little rituals, whatever it was that prepared them for battle. They all knew this mission might get hairy. It was an audacious daylight thrust into the Black Sea, the very heart of Habergidir territory in central Mogadishu, and Warlord Aidid's stronghold. Their target was a 3-story house of whitewashed stone with a flat roof, a modern modular home in one of the city's few remaining clusters of intact large buildings, surrounded by blocks and blocks of tin-roofed dwellings of muddy stone. Hundreds of thousands of clan members lived in this labyrinth of irregular dirt streets and cactus-lined paths. There were no decent maps. Pure Indian country. The men had watched the rockets being loaded on the AH-6s. Garrison hadn't done that on any of their earlier missions. It meant they were expecting trouble. The men had girded themselves with extra ammo, stuffing magazines and grenades into every available pocket and pouch of their load-bearing harnesses, leaving behind canteens, bayonets, night-vision goggles, and any other gear they felt would be dead weight on a fast daylight raid. The prospect of getting into a scrape didn't worry them. Not at all. They welcomed it. They were predators, heavy metal avengers, unstoppable, invincible. The feeling was, after 6 weeks of diddling around, they were finally going in to kick some serious Somali ass. It was 3:32 p.m. when the chalk leader inside the lead Blackhawk, Super 6-4, heard over the intercom the soft voice of the pilot, Chief Warrant Officer Mike Durant, clearly pleased. Durant announced, "Fucking Irene!" And the Armada launched, lifting off from the shabby airport by the sea into an embracing blue vista of sky and Indian Ocean. They eased out across a littered strip of white sand and moved low and fast over running breakers that formed faint crests parallel to the shore. In close formation, they banked and flew down the coastline southwest. From each bird, the booted legs of the eager soldiers dangled from the benches and open doors. Unrolling toward a hazy desert horizon, Mogadishu in mid-afternoon sun was so bright it was as if the aperture on the world's lens was stuck one click wide. From a distance, the ancient port city had an auburn hue, with its streets of ochre sand and its rooftops of Spanish tile and rusted tin. The only tall structures still standing after years of civil war were the ornate white towers of mosques, Islam being the only thing all Somalia held sacred. There were many scrub trees, the tallest just over the low rooftops, and between them high stone walls with pale traces of yellow and pink and gray, fading remnants of pre-civil war civility. Set there along the coast, framed to the west by desert and the east by gleaming teal ocean, it might have been some sleepy Mediterranean resort. As the helicopter force swept in over it, gliding back in from the ocean and then banking right and sprinting northeast along the city's western edge, Mogadishu spread beneath them in its awful reality. A catastrophe. The world capital of things gone completely to hell. It was as if the city had been ravaged by some fatal urban disease. The few paved avenues were crumbling and littered with mountains of trash, debris, and the rusted hulks of burned-out vehicles. Those walls and buildings that had not been reduced to heaps of gray rubble were pockmarked with bullet scars. Telephone poles leaned at ominous angles like voodoo totems topped by stiff sprays of dreadlocks, the stubs of their severed wires long since stripped for sale on the thriving black market. Public spaces displayed the hulking stone platforms that once held statuary from the heroic old days of dictator Mohamed Siad Barre, the national memory stripped bare, not out of revolutionary fervor, but to sell the bronze and copper for scrap. The few proud old government and university buildings that still stood were inhabited now by refugees. Everything of value had been looted, right down to metal window frames, doorknobs, and hinges. At night, campfires glowed from third and fourth story windows of the old Polytechnic Institute. Every open space was clotted with the dense, makeshift villages of the disinherited. Round stick huts covered with layers of rags and shacks made of scavenged scraps of wood and patches of rusted tin. From above, they looked like an advanced stage of some festering urban rot. In his bird, Super 6-7, Eversman rehearsed the plan in his mind. By the time they reached the street, the D-boys would already be taking down the target house, rounding up Somali prisoners, and shooting anyone foolish enough to fight back. Word was, there were two big boys in this house, men whom the task force had identified as Tier 1 personalities, ID's top men. As the D-boys did their work and the Rangers kept the curious at bay, the ground convoy of trucks and Humvees would roll in through the city, right up to the target house. The prisoners would be herded into the trucks. The assault team and blocking force would jump in behind them, and they would all drive back to finish out a nice Sunday afternoon on the beach. It would take about an hour. To make room for the Rangers and the Blackhawks, the seats in back had been removed. The men who were not in the doorways were squatting on ammo cans or seated on flak-proof Kevlar panels laid out on the floor. They all wore desert camouflage fatigues with Kevlar vests and helmets and about 50 pounds of equipment and ammo strapped to their load-bearing harnesses, which fit on over the vests. All had goggles and thick leather gloves. Those layers of gear made even the slightest of them look bulky, robotic, and intimidating. Stripped down to their dirt-brown T-shirts and black shorts, which is how they spent most of their time in the hangar, most looked like the pimply teenagers they were, average age 19. They were immensely proud of their Ranger status. It spared them most of the numbing, non-combat-related routine that drove many an Army enlistee nuts. The Rangers trained for war full-time. They were fitter, faster, and first. "Rangers lead the way," was their motto. Each had volunteered at least 3 times to get where they were, for the Army, for Airborne, and for the Rangers. They were the cream, the most highly motivated young soldiers of their generation, selected to fit the Army's ideal. They were all male, and, revealingly, nearly all white. There were only 2 blacks among the 140-man company. Some were professional soldiers, like Lieutenant Larry Perino, a 1990 West Point graduate. Some were overachievers in search of a different challenge, like Specialist John Waddell on Chalk 2, who had enlisted after finishing high school in Natchez, Mississippi, with a 4.0 GPA. Some were daredevils in search of a physical challenge. Others were self-improvers, young men who had found themselves adrift after high school, or in trouble with drugs, booze, the law, or all three. They were harder edged than most young men of their generation, who, on this Sunday in early autumn, were weeks into their fall college semester. Most of these Rangers had been kicked around some, had tasted failure. But there were no goof-offs. Every man had worked to be here, probably harder than he'd ever worked in his life. Those with troubled pasts had taken harsh measure of themselves. Beneath their best hard-ass act, most were achingly earnest, patriotic, and idealistic. They had literally taken the Army up on its offer to be all you can be. They held themselves to a higher standard than normal soldiers. With their buff bodies, distinct crew cuts, sides and back of the head completely shaved, and their grunted hooah greeting, they saw themselves as the Army at its gung-ho best. Many, if they could make it, aspired to join Special Forces, maybe even get picked to try out for Delta, the Hale's secret super soldiers now leading this force in. Only the very best of them would be invited to try out, and only 1 of every 10 invited would make it through selection. In this ancient male hierarchy, the Rangers were a few steps up the ladder, but the D-Boys owned the uppermost rung. Rangers knew the surest path to that height was combat experience. So far, Mog had been mostly a tease. War was always about to happen. About to happen. Even the missions, exciting as they'd been, had fallen short. The Somalis, whom they called Skinnies or Sammies, had taken a few wild shots at them, enough to get the Rangers' blood up and unleash a hellish torrent of return fire, but nothing that qualified as a genuine balls-out firefight. Which is what they wanted, all of these guys. If there were any hesitant thoughts, they were buttoned tight. A lot of these men had started as afraid of war as anyone. But the fear had been drummed out, especially in Ranger training. About 1/4 of those who volunteered washed out, enough so that those who emerged with their Ranger tab at the end were riding the headiest wave of accomplishment in their young lives. The weak had been weeded out. The strong had stepped up. Then came weeks, months, years of constant training. The Huas couldn't wait to go to war. They were an all-star football team that had endured bruising, exhausting, dangerous practice sessions 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, for years, without ever getting to play a game. They yearned for battle. They passed around the dog-eared paperback memoirs of soldiers from past conflicts, many written by former Rangers, and savored the affectionate, comradely tone of their stories, feeling bad for the poor suckers who bought it, or got crippled, or maimed, but identifying with the righteous men who survived the experience whole. They studied the old photos, which were the same from every war, young men looking dirty and tired, half-dressed in army combat fatigues, dog tags hanging around their skinny necks, posing with arms draped over each other's shoulders in exotic lands. They could see themselves in those snapshots, surrounded by their buddies, fighting their war. It was the test, the only one that counted. Sergeant Mike Goodell had tried to explain this to his mother one time on leave in Illinois. His mom was a nurse, incredulous at his bravado. "Why would anybody want to go to war?" she asked. Goodell told her it would be like, as a nurse, after all her training, never getting the chance to work in a hospital. It would be like that. "You want to find out if you can really do the job," he explained. Like those guys in books, they'd been tested and proven. It was another generation of Rangers' turn now. Their turn. It didn't matter that none of the men in these helicopters knew enough to write a high school paper about Somalia. They took the Army's line without hesitation. Warlords had so ravaged the nation, battling among themselves, that their people were starving to death. When the world sent food, the evil warlords hoarded it and killed those who tried to stop them. So the civilized world had decided to lower the hammer, invite the baddest boys on the planet over to clean things up. Nuff said. Little the Rangers had seen since arriving at the end of August had altered that perception. Mogadishu was like the post-apocalyptic world of Mel Gibson's Mad Max movies, a world ruled by roving gangs of armed thugs. They were here to rout the worst of the warlords and restore sanity and civilization. Eversman had always just enjoyed being a ranger. He wasn't sure how he felt about being in charge, even if it was just temporary. He'd won the distinction by default. His platoon sergeant had been summoned home by an illness in his family, and then the guy who replaced him had keeled over with an epileptic seizure. He, too, had been sent home. Eversman was the senior man in line. He accepted the task hesitantly. That morning at mass in the mess, he'd prayed about it. Airborne now at last, Eversman swelled with energy and pride as he looked out over the full armada. It was a state-of-the-art military force. Already circling high above the target was the slickest intelligence support America had to offer, including satellites, a high-flying P-3 Orion spy plane, and 3 OH-58 observation helicopters, which looked like the bubble-front little bird choppers with a 5-foot bulbous polyp growing out of the top. The observation birds were equipped with video cameras and radio equipment that would relay the action live to General Garrison and the other senior officers in the Joint Operations Center, JOC, back at the beach. Movie makers and popular authors might strain to imagine the peak capabilities of the U.S. military, but here was the real thing about to strike. It was a well-oiled, fully equipped, late 20th century fighting machine. America's best were going to war, and Sergeant Matt Eversman was among them. Chapter 2. It was only a 3-minute flight to the target. With the earphones on, Eversman could listen to most of the frequencies in use. There was the command net, which linked the commanders on the ground to Matthews and Harrell, circling overhead in the command and control, or C2 Black Hawk, and with Garrison and the other brass back at the JOC. The pilots had their own link to Air Commander Matthews, and Delta and the Rangers each had their own internal radio links. For the duration of the mission, all other broadcast frequencies in the city were being jammed. Inside the steady scratch of static, Eversman heard a confusing overlap of calm voices, all the different elements preparing for the assault. By the time the Blackhawks had moved down low over the city for their final approach from the north, the advance little birds were already closing in on the target. There was still time to abort the mission. Burning tires on the street near the target triggered momentary alarm. Somalis often set fires to signal trouble and summon militia. Could they be flying into an ambush?
"Those tires, have they been burning for a pretty good period of time, or did they just light them? Over," asked a little bird pilot.
"Those tires were burning this morning when we were up,"
answered a pilot on one of the observation birds. 2 minutes, the Super 6-7 pilot alerted Eversman. The little birds moved into position for their bump, a sudden climb, and then a dive that would sweep them over the target house with their rockets and guns pointing down. One by one, the various units would repeat Lucy, the code word for the assault to begin. Romeo 6-4, Colonel Harrell. Kilo 6-4, Captain Scott Miller, the Delta Assault Force commander. Barber 5-1, veteran pilot Chief Warrant Officer Randy Jones in the lead AH-6 gunship. Juliet 6-4, Captain Mike Steele, the Ranger commander aboard Durant's bird. And Uniform 6-4, Lieutenant Colonel Danny McKnight, who was commanding the ground convoy poised to take them all out. The convoy had rolled up to a spot several blocks away.
"This is Romeo 6-4 to all elements. Lucy, Lucy, Lucy.
This is Kilo 6-4, Roger, Lucy.
This is Barber 5-1, Roger, Lucy.
Juliet 6-4, Roger, Lucy.
This is Uniform 6-4, Roger, Lucy.
All elements, Lucy."
It was 3:43 p.m. On the screen in the JOC, commanders saw a crowded Mogadishu neighborhood, in much better shape than most. The Olympic Hotel was the most obvious landmark, a five-story white building that looked like stacked rectangular blocks with square balconies at each level. There was another similar large building on the same side of the street one block south. Both cast long shadows over Holwadig Road, the wide paved street that ran before them. At the intersections where dirt alleys crossed Holwadig, sandy soil drifted across the pavement. The soil was a striking rust orange in the late afternoon light. There were trees in the courtyards and between some of the smaller houses. The target building was across Holwadig, from the hotel one block north. It was built in the same stacked block style, L-shaped, with three stories to the rear and a flat roof over the two stories in front. It wrapped around a small southern courtyard toward the rear and was enclosed, as was the whole long block, by a high stone wall. Moving in front, on Holwadig, were cars and people and donkey carts. It was a normal Sunday afternoon. The target area was just blocks away from the center of the Bakara market, the busiest in the city. Conditioned to the helicopters now, people moving below did not even look up as the first two little birds came sweeping into the frame from the top, from the north, and then banked sharply east and moved off the screen. Neither chopper fired a shot. 1 minute, the Super 6-7 pilot informed Eversman. The Delta operators would go in first to storm the building. The Rangers would come in behind them, roping down from the Blackhawks to form a perimeter around the target block. Delta rode in on benches outside the bubble frames of the four MH-6 little birds, each chopper carrying a four-man team. They wore small black flak vests and plastic hockey helmets over a radio earplug and a wraparound microphone that kept them in constant voice contact with each other. They wore no insignias on their uniforms. hanging out over the street on their low, fast approach. They scanned the people below, their upturned, startled faces, their hands, their demeanor, trying to read what would happen when they hit the street. As the little birds came in, the crowd spooked. People and cars began to scatter. Wind from the powerful rotors knocked some people down and tore the colorful robes off some of the women. A few of the rangers, still high overhead, spotted people below gesturing up at them eagerly, as if inviting them to come down to the streets and fight. The first two little birds landed immediately south of the target building on the narrow, rutted alley, blowing up thick clouds of dust. The brownout was so severe that the pilots and men on the side benches could see nothing looking down. One of the choppers found its original landing spot taken by the first chopper in, so it banked right, performed a quick circle to the west, and came down directly in front of the target. Sergeant First Class Norm Hooten, a team leader on the fourth little bird, felt the rotor blade on his chopper actually nick the side of the target building as it came to a hover. Figuring the bird had gone as low as it could, Hooten and his team kicked their fast rope and jumped for it, planning to slide down the rest of the way. It was the world's shortest fast rope. They were only a foot off the ground. They moved directly toward the house. Taking down a house like this was Delta's specialty. Speed was critical. When a crowded house was filled suddenly with explosions, smoke, and flashes of light, those inside were momentarily frightened and disoriented. Experience showed that most would drop down and move to the corners. So long as Delta caught them in this startled state, most would follow stern, simple commands without question. The Rangers had watched the D-Boys at work now on several missions, and the operators had moved in with such speed and authority it was hard to imagine anyone having the presence of mind to resist. But just a few seconds made a difference. The more time those inside had to sort out what was happening, the harder they would be to subdue. The lead assault team that landed on the southern alley, led by Sergeant First Class Matt Ryerson, tossed harmless flashbang grenades into the courtyard and pushed open a metal gate leading inside. They raced up some back steps and directly into the house, shouting for those inside to get down. Hooten's four-man team, along with one led by Sergeant First Class Paul Howe, charged toward the west side of the building, facing Holwadig Road. Hooten's team entered a shop with colorful cartoons of typewriters, pens, pencils, and other office items painted on the front walls, the Olympic Stationery Store. Inside were six or seven Somalis who promptly dropped to the floor and stretched their arms in front of them in response to the barked commands. Hooten could hear sporadic gunfire outside already, much more than he'd heard on any of the previous missions. Howe's team entered through the next doorway down. The thickly muscled sergeant kicked the legs out from under a stunned Somali man just outside the doorway, dropping him. Howe swept the room with his CAR-15, a black, futuristic-looking weapon with a pump-action shotgun attached to the bayonet lug in front. It was important to assert immediate control. All he found was a warehouse filled with sacks and odds and ends. Both teams knew they were looking for a residence, so they quickly moved back out to the street. They ran south along Holwadig and turned left, heading for the courtyard their teammates had already broken into. They rounded the corner in a worsening dust storm. The Black Hawks were moving in. The first, carrying the Delta ground commander and a support element, flared and hovered about a block north of the target on Holwadig as Captain Miller and the other commandos on board roped down. Along with another Black Hawk full of assaulters, they would be the second wave to storm the house. Behind them came the Rangers on four Black Hawks, roping down to positions at the four corners of the block to form the assault's outer perimeter. As ropes dropped from Black Hawk Super 6-6, hovering over the southwest corner, Chalk 3 began sliding down to the street in twos, one man from each side of the bird. A crew chief shouted, "No fear!" to each man who exited his side of the aircraft. As Sergeant Kenny Thomas reached for the rope, he thought, "Fuck you, pal. You're not the one going in." Hovering high over Holwadig, 2 blocks north, the Super 6-7 pilot told Eversman, "Prepare to throw the ropes." Chalk 4 was at about 70 feet, higher than they'd ever fast-roped, yet dust from the street was in the open doors. Waiting for the other 5 Black Hawks to get in position, it seemed to Eversman that they had held their hover for a dangerously long time. Even over the sound of the rotor and engines, the men could hear the pop of gunfire. A Black Hawk hanging in the sky like that made a big target. The 3-inch-thick nylon ropes were coiled before the doors on both sides. Specialist Dave Deemer was waiting in the right side door with Sergeant Casey Joyce. At the head of the line at the left door was the kid, Blackburn. When they kicked out the ropes at the pilot's command, one dropped down on a car. This delayed things further. The Black Hawk jerked forward, trying to drag the rope free. "We're a little short of our desired position," the pilot informed Eversman. They were going in about a block north of their corner. "No problem," he said. The sergeant felt it would be safer on the ground. "We're about 100 meters short," the pilot warned. Eversman gave him a thumbs up. Men started leaping. The door gunners shouted, "Go, go, go!" Eversman would be the last man out. He removed the headphones and was momentarily deafened by the noise of the helicopter and the explosions and gunfire below. Ordinarily, Eversman wore earplugs on missions, but he'd left them out today because he knew he'd have the headphones. He draped them over his canteen and reached for his goggles. Battling the excitement and confusion, all his movements became deliberate. He would fasten the goggles over his eyes, and then, mindful of the crew chief's instruction, would set the headphones on his seat before he left. But the damn strap on his goggles snapped. Eversman fiddled with it for a moment as the last of his men leapt out, trying to find a way to fix them, saw that it was his turn to hit the rope, chucked the goggles, and jumped, ripping the headset cord from the ceiling and taking the earphones right out of the helicopter with him. He hadn't realized how high up they were. The slide down was far longer than any they'd done in training. Friction burned through his heavy leather gloves, leaving the palms of his hands raw, and he felt terribly vulnerable, fully extended on the rope for what felt like twice the normal time. As he neared the ground, through the swirling dust below his feet, he saw one of his men stretched out on his back at the bottom of the rope. Eversman's heart sank. Somebody's been shot already. He gripped the rope hard to keep himself from landing right on top of the guy. It was the kid. Eversman's feet touched the street next to him, and the crew chiefs above released the ropes. They dropped, twisting, and slapped down across the pavement. As the Black Hawk moved away, the noise and dust began to ease, and the city's musky odor bore in like the smell of something overripe. Blackburn was bleeding from the nose and ears. Private First Class Mark Good, the medic, was already at work on him. The kid had one eye shut and the other open. Blood was coming from his mouth, and he was making a gurgling sound. He was unconscious. Good had been through emergency medical training, but this was beyond him. It was the most severe injury the task force had seen in Somalia. Blackburn hadn't been shot. He'd fallen. He'd somehow missed the rope. 70 feet straight down to the street. He had just been reassigned as assistant to the Chalk 60 gunner, and he'd been carrying a lot of ammo, so he was heavier than he'd ever been on a fast rope. That, the excitement, the extreme height of the rope in, for whatever reason, he hadn't held on. He looked all busted up inside. Eversman stepped away. He took a quick count of his chalk. Holwadig was about 15 yards wide, littered with debris, as was all of Mogadishu. The dust cloud thinned, and he could see his men had peeled off as planned against the mud-stained stone walls on either side of the street. That left Eversman in the middle of the road with Blackburn and Good. It was hot, and fine sand was caked in his eyes, nose, and ears. They were taking fire, but it wasn't accurate. Oddly, it hadn't even registered with the sergeant at first. You would think bullets flying past would command your attention, but he'd been too preoccupied to notice. Now he did. Passing bullets made a loud snap, like cracking a stick of dry hickory. Eversman had never been shot at before. So this is what it's like. As big a target as he made, he figured he'd better find some cover. He and Good grabbed Blackburn under the arms and head, trying to keep his neck straight, and dragged him to the west side of the intersection. There, they squatted behind two parked cars. Eversman shouted up the street to his radio operator, Private First Class Jason Moore, and asked him to raise Captain Mike Steele on the company net. Steele and two lieutenants, Larry Perino and Jim Lechner, had roped down with the rest of Chalk 1 at the southeast corner of the target block. Chalk 4 was at the northwest corner. Minutes passed. Moore shouted back down the street to say he couldn't get Steele.
"What do you mean you can't get him?"
Moore just shrugged. The tobacco-chewing roughneck from Princeton, New Jersey, was wearing a headset under his helmet that allowed him to talk without tying up his hands. Before leaving, he'd taped the on-off switch for his microphone to his rifle. A nifty touch, he thought. But as he roped in, he'd inadvertently clasped the connecting wire against the rope. Friction had burned right through it. Moore hadn't noticed it yet, however, and couldn't figure out why his calls weren't being heard. Eversman tried his walkie-talkie. Again, Steele didn't answer, but after several tries, Lieutenant Perino came on the line. The sergeant knew this was their first time in combat, and his first time in charge, so he made a particular effort to speak slowly and clearly. He explained that Blackburn had fallen and was hurt bad. He needed to come out. Eversman tried to convey urgency without alarm.
"Say again," said Perino.
The sergeant's voice was fading in and out on his radio. Eversman repeated himself. There was a delay. Then Perino's voice came back.
"Say all again, over."
Eversman was shouting now. He repeated, "Man down. We need to extract him ASAP."
"Calm down," Perino said.
That really burned Eversman. "This is one hell of a time to start sharpshooting me." The radio call brought two Delta medics running up Holbadig, Sergeants First Class Kurt Schmid and Bart Bullock. The more experienced men quickly began assisting Good. Schmid inserted a tube down Blackburn's throat to help him breathe. Bullock put a needle in the kid's arm and hooked up an IV. Fire was growing heavier. To the officers watching on screens in the command center, it was like they had poked a stick into a hornet's nest. It was an amazing and unnerving thing to view a battle in real time. Cameras from high over the fight captured crowds of Somalis throughout the area erecting barricades and lighting tires to summon help. Thousands of people were pouring into the streets, many with weapons. They were racing from all directions toward the Bakara market, where the mass of helicopters overhead clearly marked the fight throughout the city. Moving in from more distant parts were vehicles overflowing with armed men. The largest number appeared to be coming from the north, directly toward Eversman's position and that of Chalk 2, which had roped in at the northeast corner. Eversman's men had fanned out and were shooting in every direction except back toward the target building. Across the street from where the medics were working on Blackburn, Sergeant Casey Joyce had his M16 trained on the growing crowd to the north. Somalis approached in groups of a dozen or more from around corners several blocks up, and others, closer, darted in and out of alleys taking shots at them. They were wary of the Americans' guns, but edging in. The Rangers were bound by strict rules of engagement. They were to shoot only at someone who pointed a weapon at them, but already this was unrealistic. It was clear they were being shot at, and down the street they could see Somalis with guns. But those with guns were intermingled with the unarmed, including women and children. The Somalis were strange that way. Most non-combatants who heard gunshots and explosions would flee. Whenever there was a disturbance in Mogadishu, people would throng to the spot. Men, women, children, even the aged and infirm. It was like some national imperative to bear witness. Rangers peering down their sights silently begged the gawkers to get the hell out of the way. Things were not playing out according to the neat script in Eversman's head. His chalk was still a block north of their position. He'd figured they could just hoof it down once they got on the ground, but Blackburn Falling and the unexpected volume of gunfire had ruled that out. Time played tricks. It would be hard to explain to someone who wasn't there. Events outside him seemed to be happening at a frantic pace, but his own perceptions had slowed. Seconds were like minutes. He had no idea how much time had gone by. 2 minutes? 5? 10? It was hard to believe things could have gone so much to hell in such a short time. He knew the D-boys worked fast. He kept checking behind him to see if the ground convoy had moved up. It was too early for that, but he looked anyway, wishing, because that would be a sign that things were wrapping up. He must have looked a dozen times before he saw the first Humvee round the corner about 3 blocks down. What a relief. Maybe the D-boys have finished, and we can roll out of here. Schmid, the Delta medic, had examined Blackburn more closely and was alarmed. The kid had a severe head injury at a minimum, and there was a big lump on the back of his neck. It might be a break. He looked up at Eversman. "He's litter urgent, Sergeant. We need to extract him right now or he's going to die." Eversman called Perino again. "Listen, we really need to move this guy or he's going to die. Can't you send somebody up the street?" No, the Humvees could not move up. Eversman relayed this news to the Delta medic. "Listen, Sergeant, we've got to get him out," said Schmid. So Eversman summoned two of the sergeants in his chalk, Casey Joyce and Jeff McLaughlin, who came running. He addressed the more senior of the two, McLaughlin, shouting over the escalating noise of the fight. "You need to move Blackburn down to those Humvees, toward the target." They unfolded a compact litter and placed Blackburn on it. 5 men took off with him, Joyce and McLaughlin in front, Bullock and Schmid in back, with Good running alongside, holding up the IV bag connected to the kid's arm. They ran, stooped. McLaughlin didn't think Blackburn was going to make it. On the litter, he was dead weight, still bleeding from the nose and mouth. They were all yelling at him, "Hang on! Hang on!" But by the look of him, he had already let go. They had to keep setting down the litter to return fire. They would run a few steps, set Blackburn down, shoot, then pick him up and carry him a few more steps, then put him down again. "We've got to get those Humvees to come to us," said Schmid. "We keep picking him up and putting him down like this, and we're going to kill him." Joyce volunteered to fetch a Humvee. He took off running on his own. Chapter 3. On the screens, and from the speakers in the JOC, everything appeared to be going smoothly. The command center was a whitewashed 2-story structure adjacent to the hangar at Task Force Rangers Airport Base. A mortar round had fallen on it at some point, and the roof was caved in on one side. It bristled with so many antennae and wires that the men called it the Porcupine. On the first floor, off a long corridor, there were 3 rooms where senior officers sat wearing headphones and watching TV screens. General Garrison sat in the back of the operations room, chewing his cigar and taking it all in. Color images of the fight were coming from cameras in the Orion spy plane and the observation helicopters, and there were 5 or 6 radio frequencies buzzing. Garrison and his staff probably had more instant information about this unfolding battle than any commanders in history, but there wasn't much they could do but watch and listen. So long as things stayed on course, any decisions would be made by the men in the fight. The general's job was to stay on top of the situation and try to think 1 or 2 steps ahead. In the event things went wrong, he could call across the city to the UN compound, where troops from the 10th Mountain Division waited, three regular army companies in varying degrees of readiness. So far, there was no need. Other than one injured ranger, the mission was clean. At about the same time, they learned of Blackburn's fall. The D-boys inside the target building radioed that they'd found the men they were looking for. This was going to be a success. It had been risky, going into Ideed's Black Sea neighborhood in daylight. The nearby Bakara market was the center of the Habergidir world. Dropping in next door was a thumb in the warlord's eye. The UN forces stationed in Mogh, most of them Pakistanis, since the U.S. Marines had pulled out in May, wouldn't go near that part of town. It was the one place in the city where Ideed's forces could mount a serious fight on short notice, and Garrison knew the dangers of slugging it out there. Washington's commitment to Somalia wouldn't withstand many American losses. He had warned in a memo just weeks before, "If we go into the vicinity of the Bakara market, there's no question we'll win the gunfight, but we might lose the war." The timing was also risky. Garrison's task force preferred to work at night. Their helicopters were flown by the crack pilots of the 160th SOAR, who had dubbed themselves the Night Stalkers. They were expert at flying totally black. With night vision devices, they could move around on a moonless night like it was midday. The unit's pilots had been involved in almost every U.S. ground combat operation since Vietnam. When they weren't fighting, they were practicing, and their skills were simply amazing. These pilots were fearless and could fly helicopters in and out of spaces where it would be hard to insert them with a crane. Darkness made the speed and precision of the D-boys and rangers that much more deadly. Night afforded still another advantage. Many Somali men, particularly the young men who cruised around Mogh on technicals, vehicles with 50-caliber machine guns bolted in back, were addicted to khat, a mild amphetamine that looks like watercress. Mid-afternoon was the height of the daily cycle. Most started chewing at about noon, and by late afternoon were wired, jumpy, and raring to go. Late at night, it was just the opposite. The cot chewers had crashed. So today's mission called for going to the worst place in Mogh at the worst possible time. Still, the chance of bagging two of Ideed's top men at the same time was too good to pass up. They had done three previous missions in daylight without a hitch. Risk was part of the job. They were daring men. That's why they were here. The Somalis had seen six raids now, so they more or less knew what to expect. The task force had done what it could to keep them guessing. Three times daily, mission or no mission, Garrison would scramble the whole force onto helicopters and send them up over the city. The Rangers loved it at first. You piled into the back end of a Black Hawk and held on for dear life. The hot-shot Night Stalkers would swoop down low and fast and bank so hard it would stack your insides into one half of your body. They'd rocket down streets below the roofline, with walls and people on both sides flashing past in a blur, then climb hundreds of feet and scream back down again. Corporal Jamie Smith wrote to his folks back in Long Valley, New Jersey, that the profile flights were like a ride on a roller coaster at Six Flags. But with so many flights, it got old. Garrison had also been careful to vary their tactics. They usually came in on helicopters and left by vehicles, but sometimes they came in on vehicles and left by helicopters. Sometimes they came and left on choppers or on vehicles. So the template changed. Above all, the troops were good. They were experienced and well-trained. They had come close to grabbing Ideed several times, but that wasn't their only goal. Their six previous missions had struck fear into the Habergidir ranks, and more recently they'd begun to pick off the warlord's top people. Garrison felt they had performed superbly so far, despite press accounts that portrayed them as bumblers. when they'd inadvertently arrested a group of UN employees on their first mission. The employees had been nabbed in an off-limits area with piles of black market contraband. The newspapers had dubbed them Keystone Cops. Garrison had the stories copied and posted in the hangar. That sort of thing just fired the guys up more. But to the public and to Washington officials, keenly concerned about how things played on CNN, the task force was so far a bust. They had been handed what seemed like a simple assignment. Capture the tin-horned Somali warlord, Mohammed Farah Aidid, or, failing that, take down his organization. And for 6 weeks now, they'd had precious little visible success. Patience was wearing thin, and pressure for progress was mounting. Just that morning, Garrison had been stewing about it in his office. It was like trying to hit a curveball blindfolded. Here he had a force of men he could drop on a building, any building, in Mogadishu with just a few minutes' notice. These weren't just any men. They were faster, stronger, smarter, and more experienced than any soldiers in the world. Point out a target building, and the D-boys could take it down so fast that the bad guys inside would be hog-tied before the sound of the flashbang grenades and door charges had stopped ringing in their ears. They could herd the whole mess of them out by truck or helicopter before the neighborhood militia even had a chance to pull on its pants. Garrison's force could do all this and even videotape the whole operation in color for training purposes, and to show off a little back at the Pentagon. But they couldn't do any of these things unless their spies on the ground pointed them at the right goddamn house. For 3 nights running, they had geared up to launch at a house where Aidid was either present or about to be, so the general spies told him. Every time, they had failed to nail it down. Garrison knew from day one that intelligence was going to be a problem. The original plan had called for a daring, well-placed lead Somali spy, the head of the CIA's local operation, to present Aidid an elegant, hand-carved cane soon after Task Force Ranger arrived. Embedded in the head of the cane was a homing beacon. It seemed like a sure thing, until on Garrison's first day in country, Lieutenant Colonel Dave McKnight, his chief of staff, informed him that their lead informant had shot himself in the head, playing Russian roulette. It was the kind of idiotic macho thing guys did when they lived too long on the edge. "He's not dead," McKnight told the general, "but we're fucked." When you worked with the locals, there were going to be setbacks. Few people knew this better than Garrison, who was the picture of American military machismo, with his gray crew cut, desert camouflage fatigues, and combat boots, a 9mm pistol strapped to a shoulder holster, and that unlit half-cigar jammed perpetually in the side of his mouth. Garrison had been living by the sword now for about 3 decades. He was one of the least known important army officers in America. He had run covert operations all over the world, Asia, the Middle East, Africa, Central America, South America, the Caribbean. One thing all these missions had in common was they required cooperation from the locals. They also demanded a low threshold for bullshit. The general was a bemused cynic. He had seen just about everything and didn't expect much, except from his men. His gruff informality suited an officer who had begun his career not as a military academy graduate, but a buck private. He had served 2 tours in Vietnam, part of it helping to run the infamously brutal Phoenix program, which ferreted out and killed Viet Cong village leaders. That was enough to iron the idealism out of anybody. Garrison had risen to general without exercising the more politic demands of generalship, which called for graceful euphemism and frequent obfuscation. He was a blunt realist who avoided the pomp and pretense of upper echelon military life. Soldiering was about fighting. It was about killing people before they killed you. It was about having your way by force and guile in a dangerous world, taking a shit in the woods, living in dirty, difficult conditions, enduring hardships and risks that could, and sometimes did, kill you. It was ugly work, which is not to say that certain men didn't enjoy it, didn't live for it. Garrison was one of those men. He embraced its cruelty. He would say, "This man needs to die." Just like that. Some people needed to die. It was how the real world worked. Nothing pleased Garrison more than a well-executed hit, and if things went to hell and you had to slug it out, then it was time to summon a dark relish for mayhem. Why be a soldier if you couldn't exult in a heart-pounding, balls-out gunfight? Which is what made him so good. He inspired loyalty and affection by not taking himself too seriously. If he told